This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. Hello, everybody. Welcome to FilmWax Radio, episode number 164. Today's episode is a conversation with Alan Berliner. He's a documentary filmmaker. If you don't know his films, you ought to. He's been making films for close to 25 years. First Cousin Once Removed is his sixth feature documentary film. Somewhere in his young adulthood, Alan started visiting his cousin Edwin Honig, who had been pretty much estranged from the rest of the family. A world-renowned poet and translator and academic, very complicated guy, but Edwin lived a life of the mind and worked in various universities in Wisconsin and Brown, and wasn't around while Alan's family lived more of a conventional Jewish New York life. And somewhere along the way, I guess Alan, who became a filmmaker and a photographer and an artist and an editor, decided to seek out Edwin and thus began a friendship would last many years. And certainly in those last years, while Edwin developed a case of Alzheimer's and gave permission to Alan to film his visits during his last years of his life. And what a film it is. It's very, very moving. It's sad. It has many, many funny moments in it, mostly intentional. I mean, in the sense that they were left in the film, in the edit. But it's a very candid look at something that we normally turn our heads away from. Alzheimer's is a painful experience for anyone who is participating in the relationship. So I went over to Alan Berliner's studio to do the interview, and I'm going to put a bunch of the photos up on Facebook. You really won't be able to truly appreciate just how amazing the studio is. I say it's about, 700 square feet, maybe 800 square feet. I'm not certain. But it seems like the entire studio is curated in a way. There are installations of cabinets where, like, when you walk in, you open a drawer of this cabinet and a noise comes out of each drawer. It's a piece of art. He kept everything. Alan keeps everything, and he's just a highly organized hoarder in the end of the day. So to go there was quite a trip. And so I'll put up all those photos up on the Facebook page, facebook.com/filmwaxradio. You could look that up and check it out. And while you're on the page, please like it. So it's going to be on HBO on September 23rd. I think you'll enjoy it thoroughly. So go try and check it out. So do try to check it out. Okay, with no further ado, my conversation with filmmaker Alan Berliner.
Somebody's heart tonight. I feel so good. I'm gonna take someone apart tonight. They put me in jail for my deviant ways. 2 years, 7 months, and 16 days. I'm back on the street in a purple haze. I feel so good.
He wrote poems. They had a private sound. A few were long and ran aground. Some were short. Let me start over. He wrote poems. They had a private sound. A few were long and ran aground. He wrote poems. Yeah. You know, I'm not really at the performance level. I'm really at the memory level here. Okay. He wrote poems. They had a private sound. A few were long and ran aground. But some were short, too bitter, or too sweet. The rest were wild, the worst discreet. Yeah, I could do that better. That's a poem that Edwin wrote about his poetry. I always sort of like that. Making fun of himself, and playful, and, you know, nice kind of nice quality to have.
It's interesting as you read that, and now I'm meeting with you, I'm already thinking about what it might be like to be in this point. You have made the film, and it's about to be broadcast on the 23rd of September, if I may as well mention it.
And, on HBO. You got to throw that in too.
A lot of people are about to see the movie.
Yeah.
Well, the process, of course, is highly personal. And then if you've been going around to festivals.
I have.
And now it's going to this other whole sphere. What is that like? Because it is such an incredibly personal film.
Well, the first thing is I'm used to it. Because I've been making, quote-unquote, personal films, one might even say incredibly personal films, for a long time now. You know, I made a film about my grandfather, I made a film about my father, I made a film about my name, made a film about my insomnia, you know? So I'm that, and that have all been on television. Four films of mine have been on public television, and this film I made about my insomnia was on HBO before. So this type of experience is something that I'm, you know, you never get used to it. Each time is a bit of filled with trepidation and excitement and satisfaction. You know, you never know where it's going to go or how it's going to go, but I'm looking forward to it.
As you just alluded to, you made films about your father and your grandfather, and I'm wondering how that compares to making a film about a cousin.
So, but my dad had all, as he would say, had all his marbles, I'm recording him, and was still alive at the end of the film, was there to sort of, the film changed my father, changed the way people looked at him, and, you know, he was able to participate in a lot of the dimensions of that kind of experience. Ed was no longer with us. And the other thing is that this film takes Edwin through his metamorphosis, through memory loss, through Alzheimer's, and goes to a very deep place. I mean, memory loss is a kind of death, you know, in its own way. And so this film, in many ways, goes deeper into the abyss, into the darker, shadowy corners of the human condition than anything I've ever done. So that in and of itself is new territory for me.
Yeah, you can see that abyss you describe in Edwin's eyes as the, you know, throughout the story in your film. Okay, just to recap, Edwin is your cousin, as described in the film's title.
He's my mother's first cousin. I mean, he is legitimately, as the genealogical charts indicate, he's my mother's first cousin. His, Edwin's father and my mother's mother were siblings. Mm-hmm. You know, Edwin's father is my mother's uncle. In my family, we called Edwin's father Uncle Abe. You know, not first uncle once removed or anything. He was our uncle in a certain way. And but the thing is, my mother wasn't close with Edwin at all. I was the only person really in my family, in the entire side, my maternal side of my family, who was connected to Edwin.
Well, I have a lot of questions about that, which we can get to in just a couple of minutes.
Sure.
But you remind me of something, and that is, as I refer to my family, there are the cousins you like who, regardless of how far removed they are, you know, they're my cousins, and then the ones that you don't like are just the rest.
It's funny, on the Berliner side of my family, my father's side of the family, we weren't very close to any of the cousins, so I always refer to them as the extras that we invite, you know, into the home movie footage for the bar mitzvahs and the weddings and the party, you know, the big parties, you know, they're just extras.
I'm sure they appreciate
to fill
that
the crowd too. Scenes, you know?
Well, hopefully they're not listening to this podcast.
It's okay. It's okay. I'm extras in their movies, too. It's okay.
So we're talking about your cousin, Edwin Hoenig, who was a world-renowned poet and academic.
Well, poet and he would have liked to have been described as a poet first, capital P, but he was also very distinguished and noted and knighted translator by Spain and Portugal.
Kind of impressive. Much of the film is told over the course of time where you visited Edwin at his home over a number of years, correct?
Five-year period.
Right. There's stuff about you and your relationships with your father, with your son.
That's correct. Both my father and my son, my father Oscar and my son Eli, are in the film.
One thing I came to appreciate on the second viewing of your film was how you drew an interesting parallel between your relationship with your son and your father with Edwin's own relationship to his sons and his mother.
Actually, Edwin's father, Uncle Abe.
Oh, okay, but also his mother, right?
Well, he didn't really talk much about his mother. I show him a picture of his mother. He looks at it and says,
"Yeah,
give it to another guy.
Give it to another guy."
Yeah. But well,
I thought that was the source of his damage.
No. Because his father, both of Edwin's parents, but especially his father, blamed him for the death of Edwin's brother.
Yeah, right.
When Edwin was five, his brother, you know, depending how the story, there are different kind of versions of the story, but his brother, how should we say, ran across the street to follow him and got hit by a truck.
Yeah.
And Edwin was blamed for, I don't know, inappropriate. He shouldn't have been blamed for anything.
But it was a burden he had to carry around for most of his life.
That's correct.
Edwin was the older brother?
He was the older brother. He's five, his brother was three. So you might say at age five, and then the parents did, you know, some cruel things to blame him or as symbols of the blame and the culpability that they made him feel. And, you know, you might say in many ways, like a poet was made at that point. The spirit of a poet was born.
Yeah.
You know, for the wrong reason, but.
Right. There's this part in the film where someone remarks how Edwin was great when he was a father to babies, but not so great once they grew up. And I was thinking how cruel life should turn out that he would have sons that basically duplicated the exact relationship with Edwin and his own younger brother. So who could blame him for his shutting down in some level? Or it's easy to understand how he might withdraw. You know, it may not be always, I guess what I'm saying is it makes sense.
Well, there's a lot of there are a lot of unconscious forces here. You know, in fact, to say that he was good with babies, you know, one might even say that when his own sons grew to or past the age of three, the age of Stanley, it's when certain things, you know, kind of got triggered, catalyzed. And so, you know, on many levels, he's recapitulating elements of his own childhood. And, you know, people do that all the time, all of us in some way. And we're not, you know, we should be held accountable, but we're not always responsible. Life is complicated that way, you know. That's what therapy's for.
I won't ask if you've gone to therapy, but having seen your earlier films, I guess what I'm getting at is this movie your way of illustrating those types of pathologies? I don't know.
Psychopathologies?
Yeah, psychopathologies. Like, this is what I discovered while making this film, and, you know, this might, in fact, make sense to people.
Well, I have about, you know, 1,001 motivations, but I had access to a very dear friend who was also a very dear relative, you know, who was a mentor to me at the same time, who, you know, gave me permission to talk with him over a long period of time while he's losing his memory, and to take that journey and to follow his metamorphosis and to see what the two of us together could somehow better understand about the role of memory in our lives and what it's like to grow old and what role memory serves and how we how we form identity and how we understand the contract of family and how we understand our place in the world and how we travel through time and how memory helps us translate our experience in the world, you know, learn from the past to live in the present and take what we learn from the past and how we live in the present and create a hope for, imagined, planned for, or otherwise, you know, constructed future. And so first and foremost, I'm after what it means to be human, you know, the human condition. That was the opportunity I saw here. Everything else, and there are lots of everything else's falls, not to say falls or follows, but everything else runs through that.
Hey, how do I know you?
You and I are first cousins once removed.
Why am I removed? I know there's a past. and I knew that I lived in it, and that I gave it up. There are things about the mind that you can't describe.
You imprison a poet, and you can't contain his head.
I've lost something. M-E-M-O-R-Y.
So what's the best thing about getting old?
That you might become young again.
Are those, I don't know, should we call them devices?
Yeah.
You know, all the subplots you're creating in terms of relationships and a backstory, are these are the things that help create a film, correct?
Well, they help the storytelling. Yeah. But, you know, I've made films about, in a way, all my films are about memory. I mean, I could talk about memory in relation to every film I've ever made. So in a way, it's a continuation of themes and weaving of themes. But, I mean, just to give you an example, Edwin is losing his memory, but it also turns out that there are many, many things that he needs to forget. You know, the tragedies of his life, the death of his brother, you know, when he was 5, the death of his wife, after 23 years of marriage, and then his estrangement from his wife and 2 sons. You know, there's a lot to forget. So that in and of itself changes. So I think I'm making a film about memory, but really I'm making a film about the power of forgetting. What even makes it another level more complicated, but you might say another level more interesting, is that from the perspective of telling the story and from the perspective of understanding his son's predicament of having a father who was problematic, to say the least, but can no longer remember what he did. Right? Edwin no longer remembers what he did. So therefore, Edwin's no longer in a position to apologize. So what do you do when you're in a situation where the person who did you wrong no longer remembers what he did and can't apologize? So should you and can you hold on to that anger? Does that give you an opening, an opportunity to forget as well, or to let go of something? Because there's something merciful in that. All I'm saying is it adds some layers to the story, for sure, in terms of the relationship between remembering and forgetting. And personally, when I began the film, I hadn't foreseen those sorts of dynamics. And understand that my film was as much about the power and the importance of forgetting as it was about the tragedy of not remembering. Or let me rephrase that. My film was as much about the power and importance of forgetting as it is about the tragedy of forgetting.
The expression forgive and forget all of a sudden takes on a whole new resonance, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
That might have made a good alternate title for the film.
Or at least that section of the film could easily be called, subtitled that. That's a very good point.
You had had discussions with Edwin about him becoming involved in the film, where he went into it knowing that that at some point or other that he would probably fall into the abyss and lose much of his memory. Is that right?
Well, he made jokes about that.
Did he?
You know, I even say in the film, I said, what if you don't recognize me when I come back? He looks at the camera and he goes, oy vey. You know, I mean, he was, you know.
I wasn't sure at this point if Edwin had lost most of his faculties or not.
No. He was pretty lucid that day. I mean, I asked him all the time, I'm going to come back. I'm going to use this in a film. And there were different levels of permission that he gave me throughout.
Sure.
You know, he would say, yeah, well, if you need it for what you're doing, of course, do it. I mean, there was different levels of lucidity. No one really knows, nor did I, where this was going to ultimately take me. Yeah. You know, I mean, I did, every time I visited him, I went looking to find Edwin. You know, that's what people do when they visit Alzheimer's people. They try to find the person.
But at a certain point during the course of the visits, you had to see that the Edwin you knew was, you know, he was gone, right? For all intents and purposes.
Well, I don't see it like that. I mean, I'm finding Edwin. There are different parts of Edwin because I had a complex relationship with him. And also, I'm also giving him the dignity that he's still Edwin, or that his identity, that several of the dimensions of his identity, of his selves, still exist. So there's Edwin the poet, you know, there's Edwin the intellectual, there's Edwin the scholar, there's Edwin the teacher, there's Edwin my cousin, there's Edwin my, I mean, Edwin, there are lots of levels here. My mentor, right. My friend, you know. And so Edwin still was ever the teacher in many ways, you know. Edwin still brought his sense of humor and his sarcasm to whatever we were talking about, even at whatever level he was in his metamorphosis. I mean, there I am talking to Edwin. You wouldn't think he'd be able to make sense. And I say, do you remember playing with this maraca that you played with Eli earlier today? And he looks at it and he says, I have no night of what I knew in the morning. That's a brilliant metaphor for memory loss, I think. Took my breath away when he said it.
Yeah.
You know, where does that come from? He's still got, the poet is still there. I'm always trying to find Edwin, you know, whether it's as a poet, as a friend, as a cousin, as a mentor, as a teacher, as a human being, always with love, you know, always with respect. You know, I always say the film, Edwin is the subject of the film, he's the object of the film, but in many ways I always considered him throughout the making of the film as the co-author in many ways.
Alan, when did you start visiting Edwin on your own? I mean, apart from when you were a kid, when you were finally an adult and you sought him out on your own.
Well, in my family, Edwin was like a rumor. Edwin had removed himself. He moved out to Wisconsin for a long time and kind of removed himself from my family, and then moved to Providence to teach at Brown University. Mm-hmm. And by that point, my mother had no relationship to him. You know, just the aforementioned Uncle Abe, you know, lived in Brooklyn. As far as I know, he lived in Brooklyn and had a son, Edwin, but he wasn't at any family things. You know, and then at the time I went to college, when I started going to college and I started to go through my own metamorphosis, understanding that I was hopefully going to become a filmmaker, when I was immersing myself in the arts, when I understood what it meant, or started to understand what it might mean to become an artist in the world, it dawned on me that I had this cousin in Providence who was the real deal, like a real poet, a man steeped in the arts who had dedicated his life to poetry, translating, writing, and I just intrigued? Reached out, more than intrigued,
yeah, yeah.
And I reached out. Now you have to understand that Edwin is 36 years old, was 36 years older than I am. That's a big gap.
Yeah.
But that was very liberating, because as excited as I was to find Edwin, Edwin was extremely, extremely, or I don't want to say equally, but Edwin was extremely touched to find me, because I was his connection back to family, which he might have estranged himself from and moved away from, but he was still wanted to be connected to. And so I brought him news, I brought him invitations to events, even if he didn't go. I was the bridge back. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I was, you know, a young person hungry to learn about poetry and the arts and things like this made him brought out both that place where friendship and relation and cousin and mentor and teacher all come together. And so we had a very, very special relationship. And that big age difference freed us, you know, from mm-hmm. of a lot of, I don't have to be a surrogate son. You don't right. have to be a surrogate father. We're like, yeah. This is special. This is right. like, we're two generations separated. You don't even know my mother, you know?
Yeah.
But I got the real, I'm your real blood relative, and right. I've got pictures to show you that you're going to be really interested to see.
Right.
You know? And I got stories, I have stories about family things that you're going to be really interested to hear. And it just was a really nice connection, you know? That's why I always say, I would not have made this film about anyone else. It's the access I had through our friendship, through our family connection, through this mentor relationship, and the fact that I understood him as a poet and knew where he came from. because we used to talk about art and poetry all the time, that I couldn't have made this film about my mother. You know? I had access to my mother. I have access. This is not a film. This is like a special film. The opportunity, the confluence of forces and factors comes. It's decades in building that allow this to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot what your question was.
That was the answer.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, I was asking about
how I met him. You asked me. Yeah.
Because, you know, there is a bit of a backstory. But yeah. I want to, just to go a little further into it, you had an artistic curiosity and an appetite, an intellectual appetite, which your relationship with Edwin seemed very perfect for, because that was his world. But I was wondering, was that something that was satisfied by the relationship with your dad? And maybe helped pave the way for this other relationship to some degree?
You know, I made a film about my father, so that's an open book, that's an open story. Ironically, I mean, the answer is, you know, my father certainly had his limitations. My father, as far as I know, never even been in a museum, to be honest with you, you know. But I didn't need Edwin for that. You know, I've had other professors and teachers along the way who...
Okay, but I thought it was more nuanced than that.
It's a lot of things all at once. And it's a special relationship. They should make a new category, you know.
Maybe you have.
Maybe I have. Yeah. But the point is, you know, I made a film about my father, who actually, in Nobody's Business, the film I made, says, I want you to remember me the way I am, the way I'm talking now, as a man who has all his marbles. And as it turned out, my father lost his memory, you know, and was in a nursing home and, you know, didn't even remember my name at the end. But I didn't shoot him, you know. The footage that's in First Cousin Once Removed of my father is taken by film crews that came to do pieces on me at the time. And they said, what do you do on a given day? I said, well, I go visit my father up on 106th Street. You know, he's in a nursing home. Well, can we go with you? Sure. And they filmed me shaving him and talking to him and taking him outside in a wheelchair and all that stuff. But I didn't film him. And they, fortunately, you know, they allowed me to use some of the footage that they shot. My point is there, I wouldn't use the word frustration, but was there some kind of yearning to deal with and reckon with memory loss in a close relative or in a loving way with someone that I didn't do with my father? Sure.
Well, look, you know, my dad is 77 years old and I'm still seeking his approval. I don't think you ever really stop wanting that from your parents. I have seen your earlier film, Intimate Strangers, that you made about your dad, and I thought it was very powerful. And I guess it seemed as though you had made peace with the fact that you and your dad were you know, very different people. And so I guess I'm just trying to figure out how much were you trying to create, you know, where that chasm was in your relationship with your dad, trying to recreate it with Edwin, really. Because in that comes understanding of who you are in a very essential way, and maybe your dad got that or maybe didn't, I don't know.
Well, at the end of the film, of the credits, he says you could have been, he says you should have been an accountant or a lawyer, an engineer, so, you chose this, you know.
Right, those things. You know, I mean, and a lot of parents might not want their children to go off and be artists or filmmakers because they want their kids to be financially secure and they want them to be safe in the world. You know, I mean, having said that, I know your dad was impressed with the film that you made about him at the end because he got to see it, and you get that in the film as well.
Yeah, I mean, my father's point really, which is very sane, I have to admit, he's basically saying, Alan, you know, I've had a lot of problems in my life, and somehow while I wasn't paying attention, you became a filmmaker. And okay, I kind of get that, but, well, if you're a filmmaker, isn't the idea that you make films about subjects that people are interested in? I mean, isn't that the idea? It's a very reasonable thing, by the way, because if you tell me that you're making a film about me, I mean, speaking about himself, that is absolutely absurd and ridiculous, because I am a nothing, I am a nobody, I got married, I grew up, I got married, I got a job, I had children, I worked hard, had my own business. I'm quoting him now. That's all. That's nothing to make a picture about. That's what he says in the film. Yeah. And it's perfectly sane, reasonable logic on his part. So, you know, I never doubted that he... you know, love me and respected and admired me, so I have no problem with that.
Alan, before we go any further, let me tell you something. I'm just an ordinary guy who's led an ordinary life. I was in the army. I got married. I raised a family. Worked hard. I had my own business. That's all. That's nothing to make a picture about.
Someone in the audience is watching right now and saying, why am I here watching this film about this guy?
I would ask too, because I don't know what the hell they're doing here. I'm being honest with you.
You should be honored.
I'm not.
Your life not only can be...
My life is nothing. My life is no different from I don't know how many billions of people's. Who the hell would care about Oscar Berliner? Who the hell am I? You know, it's ridiculous.
Everyone has a life that has something special about it.
No.
Your life has nothing special?
No.
Nothing?
Look.
How could you be so convinced about that?
You're trying to make something of nothing.
You're my father.
I have to do it. I need to do it.
You don't have to do it.
I have to do it.
Alan, you're going to do what you want to do, whether I want you to do it or I don't want you to do it. I'm telling you, you're wasting your time.
So you've had relationships that have filled the intellectual, artistic gap that may have existed with your relationship with your dad.
Well, you know, I had it. I've had it with professors. I've had it with friends. But I also had it with Edwin, who, you know, there are ineffable connections with. There were ineffable connections with that, you know, that were very powerful. And, you know, to the extent that we used to take long walks up and down the Hudson River over the years, in a way, you know, Edwin taught me how to make the film on some level, as it turned out. You know, because we used to talk about, I mean, he had certain approaches to art, you know, that art should get to the bottom of things, that art should get to the heart of matter. Don't be afraid to shock people, not for shock value, but just to get to the core, to touch people in their souls, that kind of thing. And don't be afraid, never be afraid. So you know what? I'm thinking about that while I'm working on the film. I'm not going to be afraid. And it's funny because I made a film about my grandfather before the film about my father. It's called Intimate Stranger. And that man, Joseph Casuto, who's actually the picture of him right there, that's Edwin's uncle. Anyway, I made a film about my grandfather, made a film about my father. Now, he never said so, but there was a sense, if you will, unspoken, like, you know, when are you going to make a film about me? Like, I mean, you know, in a way, in the years. And the truth is, I shot him. I used to go up to Providence with my camera, and I took portraits of him with my movie camera, and I did interviews with him, you know, audio interviews. I mean, we spoke. In fact, I have this Feshrif book over here. After he left, a number of years after he left Brown University, you know, there's an interview with me. It's called Cousin to Cousin, and you know, I'm asking him many of the same questions I even asked him in the film. What's our relationship to one another? What connects us? What are we, you know, what's this about? What's our contract to one another? And what do we share and all that? So there have been false steps and building blocks in place, in addition to all that other the confluence of all those other connective things that led to this film, that made this film, for me, rather inevitable and inexorable and completely organic to what I do and how I do it.
So it seems as almost as though the dementia wasn't so much the catalyst for you're making the film, but it actually maybe just more of provided the sense of urgency to tell it quicker than you might have otherwise.
Well, for sure. But then there's another thing, another X factor in the equation that's really important to put in perspective. Edwin identified as a poet. He was a poet. And poets are special citizens in our culture, you know. Poets are, which Edwin took very seriously. And before I even talk about him, let's just say he also taught poetry. So he taught the lives of poets, he taught the works of poets, right. He taught the messages of poets comparatively across different languages and different cultures. So the fact that my cousin, friend, mentor was also a poet who believed in the power of the poem and also believed in the power of the work of art and understood me as an artist, the fact that he was going to be the subject of this portrait that was going to take us through all this very delicate and scary territory, but also understanding that Edwin lived his life teaching and believing in the credo that the poet is the person, the citizen in our culture who makes the invisible visible, you know, that we turn to when we can't find the words for emotional experiences, when we can't find the words for our darkest fears. You know, Edwin, the poet, is the sentry that we send into the shadow spaces of life. That, you know, I felt that it made a lot of sense that this is a journey that a poet would be taking, you know, that a poet should be taking, that had poesy written all over it from the very beginning, you know. And I'd like to think that the film shows Edwin, I say to him at the end, you know, regardless of what's happened to you, never stop being a poet. And that existed on many levels. Not only did he still come up with metaphor, did he still come up with rhyme, but you take away words, he's still uttering in metered speech with beats, he's still tapping, he's still making music, you know, and he's still, you know, speaking in measured language. Every word still matters, every gesture matters. So, you know, and even at one point he says to me in the film, he says, what you're doing is like writing a poem. You're taking what people are thinking and you're changing what people are thinking to what you want them to think, which inspired me in many ways to, you know, find metaphors, to find visual ways and sound, relationship between sound and image, find ways, cinematic ways of expressing metaphor for what it means to remember, what it means to forget.
The typing sound effect, the bell that goes off when you reach the end of the page. There's a generation of people that aren't even going to know what those sounds are anymore.
That's true. There's a website right somewhere.
Yeah.
Like 10 sounds that, you know, someone under 10 would have no idea.
Or obsolete.
Sure. Or yeah. That people have never, you know, I mean,
yeah.
My own son, even like a rotary telephone, a rotary ring, although that's in our cell phones now, but yeah. Rotary dialing, they don't know. Mm-hmm. You should make a link to that. It's very interesting.
Yeah. So how do you think it came out? How do you think the film came out? Is it the film that you wanted to make?
Yeah. No, I took a journey with Edwin, and I thought he was going to live longer. I was a bit surprised when he...
Yeah.
I mean, again, his father lived till he was 95, Uncle Abe, and Edwin's grandfather, my great-grandfather, lived till he was 96. And I just know from other relatives that Edwin had the gift, if you will, of longevity.
Yeah.
And genetic longevity. So I thought he was going to live for a long time. I was surprised. He died in the May before the September of his 92nd birthday. He died at 91.
Some may refer to that as a very long life.
It's a long life. And he was aiming to live to 100, he told me, more than one occasion. Well, he knew that he had the genes to pull it off.
Sure.
Not only that, he had a pacemaker for some reason. I mean, he had a pacemaker, which was like an unnecessary insurance policy in terms of his longevity.
So, Alan, let me ask you, are you worried about your own mental well-being? Do you think about these things? Does it keep you up at night?
Well, my father lost his memory at the end of his life. His father lost his memory at the end of his life. You know, not to be flip, but do the math, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't lose sleep about it, but, you know, I know lack of sleep affects my memory a lot, which makes...
Irony.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense. If you go to some of the sites for memory loss to ward off Alzheimer's... this talk, you know, do puzzles, you know, crossword puzzles, the Sudoku things, and keep your mind active. That's remember what they that say. Means, yeah. You know, in a way, those forces, which they still, maybe they understand it, but and more they understand it, they can't stop it, but they understand it. Maybe you can delay it a little bit, but there's no firewall on that. But anyway, I make, films. They tax me pretty much every cell that I can muster. Mm-hmm. And, those are my crossword puzzles and my Sudoku. And, if I have the good fortune to continue making films, hopefully I'm staving off what may or may not be inevitable. No one knows, but no one's immune, No right. race, no right. religion, no culture, no nationality, no sex. It doesn't, it's something that each of us has to reckon with. And, the more I show the film and the more I talk to people, back to that sort of 6 degrees of separation notion, everyone knows someone. Everyone knows someone who's lost their memory.
Well, if you can outlive all the rest of the diseases in life, you might just get lucky enough to live to the age where you lose your memory, too.
That's true.
I guess what I hope for is that by the time my son is old enough, maybe they'll have figured some of this out. I have a 9-year-old. How old is yours?
9.
Play date? is he all about the Lego at this point?
He's not in a Lego phase now, but he's had major Legos.
My kid has been into Lego so long, I don't even know if we can call it a hobby anymore.
That's good. We don't have to call it Lego. We call it architect.
Kid. Right. But
architect engineering.
There's dementia in my family, and I guess I hope that when these guys are at that age that they've come a much longer way in figuring this out.
That's for sure.
I wondered, do you have anything else that you're working on at the moment or that in the pipeline?
The answer is no.
No, okay.
Yeah, sorry. I've been at this juncture many times now.
Yeah.
And I have some unconscious inklings and things that fly in irregular orbits through consciousness, but I don't allow myself to go there until I'm really finished with this film.
Hmm.
I'm very, very devoted and dedicated to each film up and through the finality of its both broadcast and festival life and so forth. I don't have a business model. I'm not someone who can say, I'm, shooting this, I'm editing that, I'm in post-production on this, and I'm traveling with this one. I don't do that one at a time. I edit the films. They're all-encompassing experiences for me. And I give them everything I have. I give them everything they ask of me, the films. And so, if it means taking a year off and not doing anything, I'm talking about the film now. While this might just appear as though a conversation that we're having, and which it certainly is, you're asking me questions about the film, and in the answering of those questions, I'm better understanding, I'm learning about what I do. So this is part of the experience of making that film. It's mm-hmm. not outside of it. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I also think that I need about a year to erase the biocomputer of all the
noise
and material and thoughts and ideas and clips and quotes and poems and everything that's in my head that became part of the process of making this film. And also, to be even more honest, I also, after each film, sort of need to forget how hard filmmaking is. Because if I didn't, I might not ever make another film.
Well, also, your particular approach to filmmaking has got to take its toll on you on some level. I mean, because you're digging deep into yourself when you make these films, and I was wondering if you would make a film that was less personal next time.
I try that all the time. I've tried that many times. After Nobody's Business, I wanted to make a film about names,
Oh, right.
And everyone's name but my own, or a little bit about my own, but it was going to mostly be everyone else's name. And I tried. It didn't work. And I always try. I have lots of stories of failed attempts to get out of my own family, to get out of my own head,
right.
but at very least to get out of the kitchen,
Yeah.
And it never works,
So,
so
embrace it. Own it, right? I guess they say.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So it doesn't concern me, worry me. That's not to say I won't actually succeed in breaking out of the prism of my own, you know, predilections and
and
history, you know, and biography. But usually, when I finally decide what to do, you know, I know it's something I'm going to be living with for several years, in this intimate, very intense, intimate way. So
you can build in that decompression time, as you describe it. Well, First Cousin Once Removed will have its broadcast premiere on HBO on September the 23rd.
It's a Monday.
Was the world premiere was last fall at the New York Film Festival?
Yeah, in October. It was October 9th, actually.
And I guess it'll be in heavy rotation on HBO coming up this fall.
Whatever they want to do with it, they're free to do with it, yeah.
I just recommend it so strongly because as I watched it a second time just earlier today before coming over, there's this one of many scenes that of Edwin with your son Eli on a visit, and just how it was so apparent how happy Edwin was to be around your son, and now having discussed all the relationships and the complexities of the father and son relationships, it really reflects just how nuanced a film you've made. I mean, it's sad, but it's painful to watch, but it's also very, very touching.
Well, thank you. I mean, listen, it's a sad film. Some people even think of it as a wrenching film. But at the same time, I'd like to think that there are levels of it and layers of it that are very uplifting. You know, I'd like to think that Edwin's life is and his story is treated with dignity, and that Edwin's strength and his charm and his spirit come through all the way through to the very end, and that that he has things to teach us and tell us and share with us as he takes that journey into the depths of the metamorphosis of memory loss and Alzheimer's. And he still has the capacity for love, still has, you know, still makes a joke, still makes fun of himself, still has a poetic core, but also I'd like to think that the film shows a deep humanity that he still has, you know, right to the very end.
Yeah.
And, that it was privilege for me to be able to take the journey with him and take that exploration. It's not an easy trip to do, and it's not, there are some I'm not trying to think the word, not uplifting, but there are some powerful lessons and powerful and compelling long pause. You can edit that.
Yes, not a problem.
Things to glean, you know, that Edwin can teach us, and that as he reports back from the front, as it were, of his experience.
Well, you talked about your having gone through this part of Edwin's life, that it was an honor and a privilege in a way, and as it is for us as we watch the film, because we're entering into something that's highly personal and something we don't usually see in, unless we have a loved one who's going through something similar to that. So it really is an amazing opportunity. So thanks for letting us take it.
Yeah. One point Edwin says in the film, it's very strange being a human being. And giggles.
Alan Berliner, thank you very much for coming on FilmWax Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, so the disclaimer. Go to iTunes, search FilmWax, subscribe to the podcast. It's the least you guys can do. Okay, I'm doing the show every weekend, so I need you guys to do your bit. If you're over there on iTunes and you're on the page, go to some of the shows, write comments, and please leave ratings, because this is the way podcast makes its way through the ranks. And, you know, it helps. It's going to be a big help, okay? You could also go to the Facebook page, as I mentioned. Go ahead and like the Facebook page. You can also subscribe to our Twitter feed, which is at FilmWax. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Alan Berliner. He's a really cool guy, and he should be making films for many years to come, so that's great. Interesting thing happened this past weekend. Well, most of my colleagues were in Toronto. I was here in New York, but I had a really good time because I did something I've never done before. I was an extra on a movie. Ira Sachs, who you may recall, who is a prior guest on Film Wax Radio, he came on right before his most recent film, Keep the Lights On. Before that came out, he came on to talk about that film, and we had a really great talk. Look for that in the archives, because it's a really good show. Anyway, so I got some sort of, I think it was probably on Facebook or an email, where, you know, saying they're looking for extras. He has a new film. It's called Love is Strange. It already has a Facebook page. It already has a Twitter feed. And basically, this is a film which stars John Lithgow, Alfred Molina, Darren Burroughs, and Marissa Tomei. Check it out, man, because... So I get called in to do this evening, and they say, show up. It's West Village at this location. And we're going to have you in the scene in this bar. Well, it's a gay bar. I don't have any... Certainly don't have any issues with playing a gay character, even though I'm really not a character. I mean, I'm a background guy. So we get there, and when I say we, I mean just me, and I meet all sorts of very nice people. And I'm at the bar, and it's where we're kind of filing in, and it's at Julius's bar. It's an historic bar. It's one of the oldest bars. It might be the oldest gay bar in the city. And we go in there, and Ira comes over, and he says, how you doing? And I chatted with him, and he ends up pulling me over and somebody else that I was sort of, you know, paired up with. And he says, sit at the bar. And we're sitting right next to John Lithgow and Alfred Molina. So through this whole scene. So we're just sitting there, and we're pretending to talk, and we're drinking pretend drinks, and sitting there while they do the scene at least, I don't know, 10 times. But they're so good to listen. I mean, you know, we can hear them because the bar is pretty quiet. Everybody is pretending to talk. They're all pantomiming. And I can listen to these guys do the scene, and they do it over, and they do it over and over, and it just doesn't get tired. And a little while later, we're standing outside getting some air, and Alvar Molina's there, and he's, you know, chatting up with folks, and I wasn't going to bother him because people are doing, like, photos with him and whatnot. Then I realized this is, you know, of all the roles Alvar Molina has played, one of the best-known roles is Dr. Octagon in Spider-Man. I know my son watched those films, and I thought, oh, my God, maybe he'll be really impressed that I get a photo of Doc Ock, and so... mildly impressed, but what can you do? I thought it was... But anyway, the point being that both guys, great, great, great actors, very nice guys, very both gentlemen. And Ira, huge talent. I think this is about his fifth feature, Love is Strange. I'm not sure exactly when it's coming out, but it looks like it's going to be a winner. So anyway, it was a joy to be part of it. Maybe I'll get a credit. I don't know. It doesn't matter. It was a lot of fun. That's it. Not going to keep you anymore. Just want to thank you very much. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. Until next week, thanks a lot for listening.